Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, April 21st on Iris. I'm your reader, Erin. Our first article on the front page, County endorses NIACC's tech plan, Board of Supervisors commits to $90,000 in matching funds by Jared McNett, Globe Gazette. A big focus in 2021 for NIACC's John Papajohn Entrepreneurial Center has been the future and what ideal jobs in the North Iowa area will look like down the road. At the, quote, State of the North Iowa, end quote, event in Mason City in February of this year, Tim Putnam, the director of NIACC's John Papajohn Entrepreneurial Center, went through keys that he thought were necessary to thrive in the digital economy of a post-COVID world. In March, NIACC hosted a digital economy summit that featured businesses such as the Clear Lake-based Kingland Software and Data Service Company to talk about the need to demensify the future workers. More recently, the NIACC John Papajohn Entrepreneurial Center applied for a grant from the U.S. Economic Development Administration's Build to Scale Venture Challenge program, specifically for a, quote, North Iowa Innovation Center, end quote, project. The local governments in Clear Lake and Mason City have both offered up money to match an investment from the EDA. On Tuesday morning, the Cerro Gordo County Board of Supervisors offered up support of its own, with the three-member group voting unanimously to approve a commitment to provide $90,000 of funding for a match of its own. In a letter to Putnam, County Board Chairman Casey Callanan wrote that the funding would be, quote, unencumbered and, quote, unrestricted and committed at the time of the award and will be available as needed to support the project, end quote. Elsewhere in the letter found in the packet for the county board meeting, Callanan called Cerro Gordo an employment and service hub of North Iowa with the diverse employment sectors. He then added that an, quote, innovation center, end quote, would only help to further diversify those sectors. COVID-19 vaccine updates. At the end of the meeting, CG Public Health Director Brian Hanfit informed the board that his department has only filed about 150 COVID-19 vaccine slots out of several hundred it intends to offer this week, which he partially attributed to vaccine supply finally catching up to vaccine demand. According to Hanfit, CG Public Health is looking to establish a walk-in vaccination clinic for COVID-19 that would not require the same kind of registration beforehand that the mass vaccination clinic on South Federal Avenue in Mason City does. Quote, we want to make sure availability is presented by Department of Public Health as well as our other partners, end quote, he said. As that potentially ramps up, Hanfit said it's possible that the mass vaccination clinic will begin to wind down in the next 8 weeks or so. Part of the rationale, again, being demand. Quote, statewide, we're seeing about half of the counties around the state not take their full allocation of doses, Hanfit said. We're seeing a decline in interest, and so public health can begin to focus on additional things, end quote. Our next front page article, Chauvin found guilty of murder in Floyd's death. Ex-officer convicted of murder, manslaughter, Minneapolis on edge by Amy Forlitti, Stephen Groves, Tammy Weber, and Steve Karnowski, Associated Press, Minneapolis. Former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin was convicted Tuesday of murder and manslaughter for pinning George Floyd to the pavement with his knee on the black man's neck in a case that touched off worldwide protests, violence, and a furious reexamination of racism and policing in the U.S. Chauvin, who is 45, could be sent to prison for decades. The verdict set off a jubilation around the city. People instantly flooded the surrounding streets downtown, running through traffic with banners. Cars blared their horns. Floyd family members who had gathered at a Minneapolis conference room could be heard cheering and even laughing. The jury of six white people and six black or multiracial people came back with its verdict about 10 hours of deliberation over 2 days. Chauvin was found guilty on all charges, second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. His face was obscured by a face mask, but little reaction could be seen beyond his eyes darting around the courtroom. His bail was immediately revoked and he was led away with his hands cuffed behind his back. Sentencing will be in 2 months. Defense attorney Eric Nelson followed Chauvin out of the courtroom without comment. As the judge asked jurors if they reached a verdict, a hush fell over the crowd, 300 strong, in a park next to the courthouse, with people listening to the proceedings on their cell phones. When the final guilty verdict was announced, the crowd roared and many people hugging, some shedding tears. At the intersection where Floyd was pinned down, a crowd chanted, quote, one down, three to go, end quote, a reference to the three other fired Minneapolis police officers facing trial in August on charges of aiding and abetting murder in Floyd's death. Janae Henry, who lives nearby, said she felt grateful and relieved, quote, I feel grounded, I can feel my feet on the concrete, she said, adding that she was looking forward to the, quote, next case with joy and optimism and strength, end quote. An ecstatic Whitney Lewis leaned halfway out a car window in a growing traffic jam of revelers waving a Black Lives Matter flag. Quote, justice was served, end quote, the 32-year-old from Minneapolis said. Quote, it means George Floyd can now rest, end quote. Prosecutor Jerry Blackwell, who pounded away at Chauvin's witness during the trial, said the verdict sends a message to Floyd's family, quote, that he was somebody, that his life matters, end quote. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison commended the bystanders at Floyd's slow-motion death who, quote, raised their voices because they knew what they were seeing was wrong and then told the whole world, end quote, what they saw. Ellison read off the names of others killed in encounters with police and said, quote, this has to end. We need true justice. That's not one case. That's social transformation that says no one is beneath the law and no one is above it, end quote. The verdict was read in a courthouse ringed with concrete barriers and razor wire and patrolled by National Guard troops in a city on edge against another round of unrest, not just because of the Chauvin case, but because of the deadly police shooting of a young Black man, Dante Wright, in Minneapolis suburb, April 11th. The jurors' identities were kept secret and will not be released until the judges decides it is safe to do so. Floyd, who was 46, died May 25th after being arrested on suspicion of passing a counterfeit $20 bill for a pack of cigarettes at a corner market. He panicked, pleaded that he was claustrophobic, and struggled with police when they tried to put him into a squad car. They put him on the ground instead. The centerpiece of the case was the excruciating bystander video of Floyd gasping repeatedly, quote, I can't breathe, end quote, and onlookers yelling at Chauvin to stop as the officer pressed his knee on or close to Floyd's neck for what authorities say was 9.5 minutes. Floyd slowly went silent and limp. Prosecutors played the footage at the earliest opportunity during opening statements, with Jerry Blackwell telling the jury, quote, believe your eyes, end quote, and it was shown over and over, analyzed one frame at a time by witnesses on both sides. In the wake of Floyd's death, demonstrations and scattered violence broke out in Minneapolis, around the country, and beyond. The furor also led to the removal of Confederate statues and other offensive symbols such as Aunt Jemima. In the months that followed, numerous states and cities restricted the use of force by police, revamped disciplinary systems, or subjected police departments to closer oversight. The, quote, blue wall of science, end quote, that often protects police accused of wrongdoing, crumbled after Floyd's death. The Minneapolis police chief quickly called it, quote, murder, and fired all four officers, and the city reached a staggering $27 million settlement with Floyd's family as jury selection was underway. Police procedure experts and law enforcement veterans inside and outside the Minneapolis department, including the chief, testified for the prosecution that Chauvin used excessive force and went against his training. Medical experts for the prosecution said Floyd died of asphyxia or lack of oxygen because his breathing was constricted by the way he was held down on his stomach, his hands cuffed behind him, a knee on his neck, and his face jammed against the ground. Chauvin's attorney called a police use of force expert and a forensic pathologist to help make the case that Chauvin acted responsibly against a struggling suspect and that Floyd died because of an underlying heart condition and his illegal drug use. Floyd had high blood pressure, an enlarged heart and narrowed arteries, and fentanyl and methamphetamine were found in his system. Under the law, police have certain leeway to use force and are judged according to whether their actions were, quote, reasonable, end quote, under the circumstances. The defense also tried to make the case that Chauvin and other officers were hindered in their duties by what they perceived as a growing hostile crowd. And our last front page article, local law enforcement reacts to Chauvin verdict, by Jared McNett, Jason Selby, Globe Gazette. On Tuesday afternoon, the jury reached a verdict at the murder trial of Derek Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer in the death of George Floyd, finding him guilty of second-degree unintentional murder, guilty of third-degree murder, and guilty of second-degree manslaughter. Ahead of and following the verdict, we contacted local law enforcement for their reactions surrounding the case. Mason City Police Chief Jeff Brinkley: what negatives have come from nearly a year of conversations about and coverage of the case, this case and the trial? Quote, I don't think just for us, for policing in general. We all get judged by the actions of one police officer anywhere in the country right now. Whatever one person is doing under the color of authority reflects on all of us. Unfortunately, we're just mired in the bad right now, end quote. Can police departments and police unions be too defensive after an unarmed civilian is shot or killed by a law enforcement officer? Example, Brooklyn Center Police raising the thin blue line flag after Dante Wright's death. Quote, we do a really tough job. When a police officer is involved, there's always the rush to judgment and there's no patience anymore. And I think that's the hard part. Sometimes there's a little bit of a circling of the wagons in terms of taking care of your own people, our own people, end quote. Do you think there are fair criticisms of the way law enforcement is currently done? Quote, I don't know. Our system is not one you can replace overnight with a new system. We have to work as hard as we can as leaders today to leave it better than we found it. We need to work to provide equity and fairness. I don't know what the better system is. Nobody has that answer because we're so ingrained in what we do. Changes need to be really intentional, ... end quote. One of the conversations that there's been a lot of is more money going toward other community resources such as mental health, substance treatment, those sorts of things would be a big help. Do you think that would be beneficial for law enforcement? Quote, if they are done correctly, we're almost 3 years into a partnership with county social services and we have made inroads in that community. We've provided better outcomes. I think there are some good practices that help us support those who need it most, end quote. Clear Lake Police Captain Mike Colby: positives to come from all of this. Quote, something that's always been at the forefront is to not always just do the minimum and move on, but how we can solve problems for people that may not always be related to the law, end quote. Does every officer need to have a firearm directly on their person? When an officer has a firearm on them at all times, does that start to impact the way they see people around them? Quote, law enforcement is expected to go into an indescribable number of situations, and oftentimes they go into a volatile situation, and those firearms are not only for an officer's protection, but for the public's protection as well. Is there enough of a sense of being an officer of the peace as opposed to someone dueling out justice? Quote, I'm not aware of anyone I've worked with who's had that mentality. We have an extensive training process before we hire somebody. We have set standards and set guidelines. Officers have to meet and continue to perform, end quote. Mitchell County Sheriff Greg Beaver was glad to see the day of the verdict arrive. He watched the trial proceedings relatively closely, and he was not surprised that Derek Chauvin was found guilty. The short time the jury deliberated told him all he needed to know. Quote, I always respect the decision of the jury, and now we'll move on from there, Beaver said. Juries have a very tough jobs to do, and they do it well. I think that in this case, they've come to the right conclusion. They had the information they needed to make the decision. I hope everyone respects it, and there's no more violence. That's not any way to solve problems. Let our system work, and you saw today that it does work, end quote. Moving to page A2, MCS hires curriculum director, by J.C. Smith, Globe Gazette. Mason City Community Schools has a new director of curriculum and instruction. Bridget Wagner, director of educational services at Waverly Shell Rock Schools, was approved for the position by the district's Board of Education on Monday night to replace the retiring Susan Piniscalvi. At its February committee of the whole meeting, the board had discussed making some changes to the position, possibly broadening the scope to make it more of a second-in-command role to Superintendent Dave Firstige. Quote, I think Dave gets spread, and I Don't know if it is fair or not, but I think he's gets a spread really thin in terms of what you're doing, end quote, Director Brent Seaton said at the meeting. Quote, I think when you have a second in command, you can delegate responsibilities to do certain things, end quote. Wagoner does not at this point have the credentials to fill that role, Verstige said on Tuesday. The board interviewed finalists at the end of March. Wagoner will make $121,940.52, according to the contract attached to Monday night's meeting agenda, plus 25 days paid vacation. Wagoner has served the Waverly Shell Rock District for 10 years, according to her profile on LinkedIn.com. Before that, she spent 10 years with Price Laboratory School, Northern University High School, serving first as a language arts teacher, then professional development and curriculum coordinator, finally interim director. She received both her bachelor's in teaching English and her master's in educational psychology from the University of Northern Iowa. Wagoner will begin her role on July 1. Our next article, MCHS NIACC announced graduation plans by J.C. Smith, Globe Gazette. Mason City High School graduation will look a little different this year. On Monday night, Superintendent Dave Verstige told the district's Board of Education that it plans to hold graduation this year at the city's multipurpose arena. The event is scheduled for 2 p.m. June 6. Graduation is usually held in the high school gymnasium. Last year, so that proper social distancing was allowed, graduation was held at the school's football stadium. Verstige said they settled on the arena to avoid having to deal with the ongoing fieldhouse construction project. In a letter sent to seniors and their families late last week, Principal Dan Long said the traditional in-person format will return, but COVID-19 guidelines will be enforced. Masks will be required, a two-seat separation between families for social distancing. Anyone experiencing symptoms should not attend. The district is, quote, bartering, end quote, with the city so that use of the area is cost neutral, Verstige said. NIACC North Iowa Area Community College is planning four separate graduation ceremonies this spring, said President Steve Scholes. Graduation is scheduled for May 7th in the school's gymnasium. Health graduates will be honored at 10:30 a.m., Career Technical at 1 p.m., Arts and Sciences Group at 1 at 3 p.m., Arts and Sciences Group 2 at 5 p.m. Masks are required for all the ceremonies, and each graduate will be allowed two tickets for guests. NIACC will also live stream the ceremonies on YouTube, youtube.com/user/myNIACC. In our next article, Clear Lakes Larch Pine Inn to host Mother's Day Tea by Melanie Mergen, Globe Gazette. Looking for Mother's Day plans? On Wednesday, May 5th, Mormon Clothiers in Mason City is teaming up with Larch Pine Inn Bed and Breakfast in Clear Lake to offer a Mother's Day tea and fashion show. Then on Sunday, May 2nd, Larch Pine Inn will host a second Mother's Day tea with a fashion show presented by Unique Boutique and the Funky Zebras, both in Clear Lake. Quote, the historic 1875 Victorian home is the perfect setting to celebrate moms, end quote, said Paula Hannes, owner of Larch Pine Inn. Quote, I know some of my most cherished memories with my mom were the times we celebrated Mother's Day and her May birthday at the Times Remembered Tea Room in Perry, Iowa, end quote. The luncheon will include, quote, a blend of sweet and savory sandwiches, salads, and cakes with a specialty tea from Holistic Harmony of Clear Lake, end quote, a press release stated. Doors for both shows will open at 1 p.m. Registration is required, and the cost to attend is $32 per person. To make a reservation, call 641-357-0345 or email info@larchpineinn.com. The Larch Pine Inn is located at 401 North 3rd Street in Clear Lake. Today in history, today is Wednesday, April 21st, the 111th day of 2021. There are 254 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On April 21st, 1836, an army of Texans led by Sam Houston defeated the Mexicans at San Jacinto, assuring Texas independence. On this date in 1649, the Maryland Toleration Act, providing for freedom of worship for all Christians, was passed by the Maryland Assembly. In 1789, John Adams was sworn in as the first vice president of the United States. In 1816, Charlotte Bronte, author of Jane Eyre, was born in Thornton, England. In 1910, author Samuel Langhorne Clemens, better known as Mark Twain, died in Reading, Connecticut at age 74. In 1918, Manfred von Richthofen, 25, the German ace known as the Red Baron, who was believed to have downed 80 enemy aircraft during World War I, was himself shot down and killed while in action over France. In 1926, Britain's Queen Elizabeth II was born in Mayfair, London. She was the first child of the Duke and Duchess of York, who later became King George VI and Queen Mother. In 1930, fire broke out inside the overcrowded Ohio Penitentiary in Columbus, killing 332 inmates. In 1975, with communist forces closing in, South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu resigned after nearly 10 years in office and fled the country. In 1976, clinical trials of the swine flu vaccine began in Washington, D.C. In 1977, the musical play Annie, based on the Little Orphan Annie comic strip, opened on Broadway, beginning a run of 2,377 performances. In 1980, Rosie Ruiz was the first woman to cross the finish line at the Boston Marathon. However, she was later exposed as a fraud. Canadian Jacqueline Garou was named the actual winner of the women's race. In 2015, an Egyptian criminal court sentenced ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi to 20 years in prison over the killing of protesters in 2012. 10 years ago, President Barack Obama announced the Justice Department was assembling a team to, quote, root out any cases of fraud or manipulation, end quote, in oil markets that might be contributing to $4 a gallon plus gasoline prices. I'm going to start with the obituaries. Gerald D., known as Jerry Corey, November 20th, 1933 to April 18th, 2021, Mason City. Gerald D., known as Jerry Corey, passed away peacefully at home on April 18th, 2021. He was born November 20th, 1933 in Dubuque, Iowa, and adopted as an infant by L. Dale and Gladys Nelson Corey. Jerry grew up in Mason City and graduated from Mason City High School in 1951 and Mason City Junior College in 1953. He served in the U.S. Army from 1953 to 55 and was stationed in Panama to guard the canal. He went through jungle training and learned Morse code. Jerry was well known as a tennis player and was once called in from the field to play on the Army's team for a tournament. He followed multiple sports, especially enjoying the Minnesota Twins and Vikings and all three Iowa University teams. Jerry was an avid tennis player, having started in his teens and playing regularly for over 60 years. He was a founding member of the North Iowa Tennis Club, which provided indoor tennis for years. After retirement, Jerry took up golf and enjoyed the camaraderie it offered beyond his tennis playing years. He was always physically active, enjoying hikes at Lime Creek Nature Center, bike riding, cross-country skiing, Earth Day cleanups, and lots of Nerf football games with his family. These activities took place after walking over 10 miles a day as a postal carrier. His other outdoor enjoyment was fishing, and he held fond memories from his 24 years of trips, quote, up north, end quote, with his buddies. Jerry enjoyed his work as a mail carrier for 34 years, enduring all types of weather. On his first day of training, he, quote, impressed, end quote, his trainer when mail from his bag accidentally fell into the sewer grate. For years, he was dropped off with his mail cart on his route. The cart was popular with kids who enjoyed rides as he pushed it along. Many caring people allowed him to warm up in their houses on winter days and offered him lemonade on warm days. Thankfully, the Postal Service moved to carrier-driven mail trucks in the early 1970s. He stayed with the same two routes and, for the majority of his years, getting to know the households that he served. After retiring from the Postal Service at age 59, he thoroughly enjoyed the post-retirement part-time jobs. One job was working for Arts and Merit Sporting Goods, where he enjoyed sales, rebuilding fishing reels, and joking with his coworkers. The other was picking up donated materials from local businesses for the North Iowa Area Education Agency. Jerry was married June 1, 1957 in Mason City to Virginia Valla. They raised a family of five: Steve, Mason City; Carolyn, spouse Mike, Vanderhanden, Apple Valley, Minnesota; Kathleen, spouse Mike, Clear Lake; Brian, Cedar Rapids; Susan, Corey; and Jeff Cougar, Des Moines. Jerry is survived by his wife of 63 years, Virginia, his five children, grandchildren, Bob's spouse, Brianna Thole, Amy Thole, Ryan's spouse, Danica Gump Thole, Aaron's spouse, Ashley Batten, Evan's spouse, Kelly Batten, Regine Cucker, Rory Dolan, and great-grandchildren, Cora Thole, Lark Thole, and Amelia Thole. He is also survived by his sister, Joanne Wright, and several nieces and nephews. He was active in Holy Family Church as an usher, sacristan, collection counter, member, and president of the church's men's club, and was a singer in the choir for 30 years. He hosted and participated in church study groups with Virginia in their home. He served on the Holy Family and Newman High School boards and was a member of the Knights of Columbus Council 1006. For 20 years, he was dedicated to his volunteer role as treasurer for St. Vincent de Paul Society, helping those in need. In addition, Jerry served with the Mercy Hospital Ambassadors for over 20 years. Jerry loved listening to music and singing. His talent stretched to the stage, playing his look-alike role of the, quote, American Gothic farmer in The Music Man, end quote, for the Mason City Community Theater. In general, he loved spending time with his wife of nearly 64 years, family, close friends, and neighbors. He and Virginia had a long and loving relationship. They enjoyed their friends and community. Jerry was a father who always took care of the needs of his family and was always present. He was preceded in death by his parents, in-laws Louis and Sarah Valla, son-in-law Dave W. Batten, and daughter-in-law Joan Corey. Visitation will be held Thursday, April 22nd, 5 to 7 p.m. at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel. A funeral mass will be held Friday, April 23rd, 10:30 a.m. at Holy Family Catholic Church of Epiphany Parish, 722 North Adams. An interment service will be held for family at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery, Mason City, the same day. In lieu of flowers and customary remembrances, memorials may be left in Jerry's honor to Epiphany Parish, Mercy One North Iowa Hospice, or to the family, who will disperse to other charities important to Jerry. The family thanks Rob Grayson and Tracy Gruders, Mercy One North Iowa Home Care, for their support and care. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast, Mason City, 641-423-2372, colonialchapels.com. Mary Ann Scron, Adele, Iowa. Mary Ann Scron, 95, of Adele, formerly of Mason City, passed away Friday, April 16th, 2021, at her daughter's home. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 24th, 2021, at Our Savior's Lutheran Church, with Pastor Matthew Mutters officiating. Interment will follow in Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Mary Scron Memorial Fund. Those wishing to leave an online condolence for the family may do so at MajorErickson.funeralhome.com. Russell James Borchardt, February 20th, 1932 to April 16th, 2021, Clear Lake. Russell James Borchardt, Clear Lake, went home to be with the Lord on Friday, April 16th, 2021. Russell was born on February 20th, 1932 on a farm in Union Township, Worth County, Iowa, to Albert William and Alma Ulkery, Emma Glassell Borchardt. Russell attended Rock Falls Consolidated Schools, graduating May 1950. Russell was inducted into the U.S. Army on October 1, 1952. He took basic training at Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, and served a 14-month tour of duty in South Korea during the Korean conflict. He served with the C Battery 69th Field Artillery Battalion, 25th Infantry Division. Russell was married to Judith A. Schwartz on September 1, 1957, at First Baptist Church, Mason City, Iowa. They were blessed with three children: Julia, spouse Lynn Rasmussen, Russell, spouse Cheryl Borchardt, and Paul, spouse Lisa Borchardt, and grandchildren Karen Rasmussen, Christopher, spouse Caleb Borchardt, and Kelly, spouse Nick Borchardt Ronke, and one great-grandson Connor Borchardt, and great-granddaughter Maddie Ann Ronke. He is survived by sisters Bethel Farenholtz, Mason City, Iowa, Janice, spouse William Felt, and sisters-in-law Karen Borchardt, and many nieces and nephews. A celebration of life service will be at a later date. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorial gifts are given to a charity of your choice. June B. Pope, April 30th, 1926 to April 18th, 2021, Rockwell. June B. Pope, 94, of Mason City. June B. Pope, 94, went peacefully to her eternal home on Sunday, April 18th, 2021 at the Rockwell Community Nursing Home. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, April 22nd, 2021 at the Clear Lake Open Bible Church, 509 South 17th Street, Clear Lake, with Pastor Will Hunsaker officiating. Services will be live streamed on the Major Erickson Funeral Home Facebook page. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service time. Interment will be held in the Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the family of June Pope or Clear Lake Open Bible Church. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. June was born April 30th, 1926 in Mason City, Iowa, the sixth daughter of Clarence and Lillian Hicks Gallagher. She married Wayne E. Pope on June 27th, 1947 at the Mason City Open Bible Church, officiated by the groom's father, the late Reverend Russell E. Pope. He thought June was the prettiest bride he had ever seen. They first made their home in Waterloo, Iowa, while Wayne attended Iowa State Teachers College, UNI. Wayne and June were the parents of five daughters, six grandchildren, and six great-grandchildren, their pride and joy. June was a lifelong member of the Open Bible Churches, both in Mason City, then Clear Lake, Iowa. She loved Jesus with all of her heart. She had a fondness for those around her and often took the younger gals under her wing. She had a heart for babies and children and taught Sunday school and vacation Bible and school and participated in women's Bible studies and circles in her younger years. She and Wayne hosted many parties at their acreage for their young married church group. She enjoyed gardening, her flowers, especially roses, and being outdoors. She and Wayne took a trip to Alaska in 1993 and enjoyed seeing the beautiful scenery along the way in their motor home. Other trips to Hawaii and the Holy Lands were highlights, as well as family fishing trips and camping. June's family was very important to her. She had a nurturing, everyone felt valued and loved by her. She felt her calling was to be a loving wife and mother, and later enjoyed being a grandmother and great-grandmother. She was known for her sweet spirit and her cooking, and made the best potato salad and pumpkin pies. Jane is survived by her loving husband, Wayne Pope of rural Mason City, and one daughter, Lori Ann Pope of Mason City, along with her two children, Amanda Farrex, spouse Mitch of Clemmy, and Joel Weisner of Iowa City. Also, her other grandchildren, Aaron, spouse Bart Bentley of Rockford, Illinois, Wesley McElwee, spouse Missy of Vinton, Leah, spouse Mark Frank of Cedar Rapids, Lee Hefty, spouse Jennifer of Corwith, and six great-grandchildren, Genesis, Kassara, Isaac, Bentley, and June, Owen and Mabel McElwee, along with many beloved nieces and nephews. Preceding her in death are her four daughters, two infant daughters, Linda and Marcia Pope, and two grown daughters, Sharon McElwee, spouse Melvin, and Sandy Peck, spouse Victor, granddaughter Amy Peck Hefty, as well as her parents and five sisters, Lola, Ella May, Eva, Gladys, spouse Dode, and Lillian, and one brother, Lowell, spouse Bobby Gallagher, as well as other relatives gone before, whom she dearly loved. We would like to thank the wonderful caring staff at the Rockwell Community Nursing and Rehab Center for their unprecedented love and care of June. Their deep concern for her was appreciated and will always be remembered. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue, Mason City, Iowa, 50401, 641-423-0924, www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Eileen Newman, March 27th, 1925 to April 18th, 2021, Clear Lake. Eileen Newman, 96, formerly of Clear Lake, passed away peacefully on Sunday, April 18th, 2021 at Heritage Care Center in Mason City. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, April 22nd, 2021 at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, 310 First Avenue North, Clear Lake. A family graveside service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 23rd, 2021 at Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City. Eileen Doris Jane Trevitt was born on a farm in rural Rockford to Irl R. and Bertha Carstens Trevitt on March 27, 1925. A graduate of Rockford High School, class of 1942, Eileen attended Hamilton Business College and graduated in 1944. She worked for 2.5 years at Armour Company in Mason City and later for Prudential Life Insurance Company in Kansas City, Missouri, in their mortgage and loan department. On October 20th in 1948, Eileen married Donald Dean Newman at the First United Methodist Church in Mason City. Into that union, two sons were born, David A. and J.D. Eileen belonged to the Clear Lake United Methodist Church, United Methodist Women, Clear Lake Senior Citizen Center, and was a life member of Disabled American Veterans Auxiliary. Left to cherish Eileen's memory are her sons, David, spouse Deborah Newman of Rockwell, and Jay Newman of Anderson, Missouri. Three grandchildren, Jason, spouse Jolene Newman, and their children, Kendall, Kinsey, and Casey, Jamie, spouse Kevin Walker, and Jana, spouse Chris Moffitt, and their children, Anya, Gracie, and Braden, a stepson, Jason, spouse Dana Mott, and their children, Brantley, Lacey, Adia, and Jalen, and two step-great-great-grandchildren, Alyssa and Brian. She was preceded in death by her husband, Donald, in 1991, parents, daughter-in-law, Ruth, in 2017, and brother, Orlwin, in 1994. Eileen's family would like to thank Heritage Care Center for their wonderful care of Eileen over the past few years. They sincerely thank all the family and friends for their visits and cards during her stay at Heritage. Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, 310 First Avenue North, Clear Lake, 641-357-2193 at colonialchapels.com. Moving to the sports section, North Iowa Bulls return with Frazier Cup. Fans greet champions as they return to Mason City by Jerry Smith, Globe Gazette. As Sean Sullivan got off the bus at the Mason City Multipurpose Arena on Tuesday, hoisting the Frazier Cup, North Iowa Bulls fans showed their appreciation with loud cheers, high fives, and cowbells. A lot of cowbells. The Bulls completed a dream season by winning the North American Tier 3 Hockey League Frazier Cup Championship Tournament on Monday, shaking off what looked to be a daunting task as the team came into the tournament as the sixth seed. Four games against four different opponents later, the Bulls finished the championship weekend by defeating the number one seed Rochester Grizzlies 5-1 on Monday to raise the Frazier Cup for the first time since 2016 and fourth time in the organization's history. North Iowa capped its, quote, decade of dominance, end quote, with its fourth national championship. The Bulls previously won USA Hockey national titles in 2013 and 2015 and a de facto national title in 2016 after the cancellation of the USA Hockey Championship tournament the previous years. Annalisa Sampson rang her cowbell when the team bus arrived, and later inside, she made the rounds getting her Bulls jersey and her team poster signed by the champions. Her favorite was Garrett Freeman. Quote, I do sports for Special Olympics, and he has my number 9, so I wanted him to sign my jersey, Sampson said. I've been a fan since they were the Outlaws, and this is a great moment, end quote. Many of the more than 250 people who covered on the arena sought out players for autographs, while others had their photos taken with the Frazier Cup. Crystal Walker and her son, Michael, were excited to take a photo with the Frazier Cup. Quote, I've been a fan for 5 years now, and this is very cool, Crystal Walker said. We love to support them, end quote. Our next article, OCH's Miller has lofty goal. Green Devils junior jumper sets sights on Drake Medal by Zach Martin, Globe Gazette. Ben Miller made sure not to be on the bubble. 2 years ago, the OCH junior leaped in a personal best of 6 feet 2 inches in the high jump and missed the cutoff for the Drake relays by a single inch. He didn't have to sweat out the weekend in 2021. Miller has increased his personal best by 2 inches and will enter Thursday's high jump at 1 p.m. for the first time in his career and a group of 11 others that have also jumped 6 feet 4 inches. The state leaders in the event are Lynn Marr, sophomore TJ Jackson, and trainer senior Noah James, who have both cleared 6 feet 9 inches. Quote, I'm very excited, end quote, Miller said. In a meet earlier this season, Miller bypassed 6 feet 5 inches to try and clear 6 feet 6 inches. He missed on all three attempts, yet he was far from frustrated. Quote, I just felt like I had enough height, just the form wasn't good, end quote, Miller said. Green Devils head coach Scott Hopel and Miller believe that 6 feet 6 inches is going to be the cutoff to get on the podium. The former has a full confidence that ladder can jump the height and higher. Quote, it depends on who shows up that day, Hopel said. I think he's going in it to medal. It'll be nice to be in good, warm weather, end quote. Miller has not competed in about 2 weeks. Coupled with all the cancellations that has happened in North Iowa, Miller has also had a broken nose. He prefers jumping in warmer weather. The expected high temperature in Des Moines will be 59 degrees with a very, very slim chance of rain. Quote, it's still important, end quote, Miller said. Hopel isn't worried about the drive his most experienced high jumper will have come Thursday. Quote, we'll see what happens, end quote, he said. Miller has grown about 3 to 4 inches since his freshman season and added about 30 pounds of muscle. That added weight initially made Miller skeptical. Quote, I knew it was mostly muscle, but I didn't know if it was going to make me jump as high, end quote, he said. Once he started jumping and clearing heights above his previous personal best, he realized the extra weight wasn't a bad thing. Neither was strengthening his core, an area that Miller admits is even more important than building muscle on his legs. Quote, working on your core helps you get over the bar, he said. You still have to contort your body, end quote. Hopel stated that missing out on the 2020 track season was a blessing in disguise for the multi-sport athlete. Quote, I can honestly say that COVID-19 was a good thing for Ben Miller, Hopel said. He stayed at home and he has his own weight room. When he came back this fall, it was a totally different person. He's done a great job, end quote. Miller has OCH's top time in the 110 high hurdles and is the second leg in the 400 and 800 relays. But he always fancied himself as a jumper, then a runner. Standing at 6'1", Miller was tied for third on the boys' basketball team in rebounds per game and also was in the top five on the football squad in total and solo tackles. Quote, I was always jumping in basketball, so I always wanted to do the high jump, Miller said. Before I start high jumping in middle school, I'd always try and touch the net in basketball. After that, I realized I could be successful in high school, end quote. The hope is to be on that stand with a medal draped around his neck. Hopel has the mindset that it can happen so long as Miller can avoid trouble by not clearing the early heights. Quote, high jumping is kind of like kicking in the NFL and college, Hopel said. It's a strange breed of individuals. You start at 5 feet 9 inches and you can be out at 5 feet 9 inches with 6 feet 3 inches qualifying, end quote. Our last sports article, MLB salary slowdown could lead to strife, by Tim Dalberg. The annual survey of opening day baseball salaries by the Associated Press usually reveals something interesting about the state of the game, and this year's version was even more interesting than most. Here's a tidbit from it that borders on surprising. Despite all you hear and read about the game's huge salaries, a big percentage of Major League Baseball players are not millionaires. That's not to say they won't be by the time they're done playing. Even those playing for minimum salary, assuming they are somewhat frugal with their money, will eventually end up with a pile of cash if their careers last long enough. And then, of course, there's Trevor Bauer making $38 million in Los Angeles this season, and Francisco Lindor's staggering 10-year, $341 million contract with the New York Mets. But of the 902 players on the opening day rosters, 417 had salaries under $1 million. That included 316, basically one of three players, making under $600,000. Equally startling in the annual study by AP baseball writer Ronald Blum is that baseball salaries have actually taken a hit in the last few years after rising at a dizzying pace for the last few decades. Their survey showed the average salaries dropped 4.8% to just under $4.17 million on opening day from the start of the 2019 season and is down 6.4% since peaking at $4.45 million in 2017. The rich are getting richer, largely because nothing is standing in the way of owners signing the latest hot players to keep fans happy. But baseball's middle class is getting squeezed. Analytics are causing teams to reevaluate how much they want to commit to non-superstars for certain skill sets, and often they discover the best answer is the lowest paid player available. Consider this, the 50 highest paid players make one-third of all the salary in baseball. The 100 highest paid players account for more than half the payroll, leaving 800 other players to split the remaining 47.6%. Meanwhile, the median salary, the point at which an equal number of players are above and below, is $1.15 million, down 30% from $1.65 million, record high at the start of 2015. For now, that means less complaining among fans about highly paid players who don't produce on the field. But with the collective bargaining agreement expiring after this season, it also means that there's a risk of no baseball come this time next year. Management and the players' union have long had a contentious relationship that seems to only be getting worse. And with salaries dropping, there are already whispers about a possible lockout or strike when the current contract expires December 1. Quote, I think some of the trends we're seeing are directly affecting the game and the players, end quote, union chief Tony Clark told The Atlantic earlier this month. Quote, and that is why it's important to have a conversation now that we are in bargaining about those trends and how they are affecting the industry, end quote. Talks toward a new contract have yet to begin, but the early indications are that they will be brutal. Owners are looking to keep things in check after Commissioner Rob Manfred said they lost $2.5 to $3 billion in last year's pandemic, shortened season while players are determined to regain the upper hand when it comes to paychecks, service time, and teams that don't spend enough money to win. To show how just difficult the negotiations figure to be, owners and players could not even come to terms before this season on expanded playoffs or the DH in the National League, things that logically would have benefited both sides. How the talks shake out remains to be seen, though fans can only hope both management and players understand that another work stoppage in baseball could cripple the game. The last one in 1994 wiped out a World Series and damaged baseball so badly there hasn't been one since, but a perfect storm seems to be brewing this time around. Management got the better end of the current deal when players seemed more interested during the negotiations in quality of life issues like a chief in every clubhouse and more days off in the season. With good reason, perhaps because they figured salaries would keep going up every year like they had for the last half century or so. They didn't, and now there's a day of reckoning ahead. How the players and owners deal with it figures to define baseball for years to come. Again, that article was written by Tim Dahlberg, who writes for the Associated Press. Our next article, Carter V.P. Mondale Left Liberal Legacy, by Doug Glass, Associated Press, Minneapolis. Former Vice President Walter F. Mondale, a liberal icon who lost one of the most lopsided presidential elections after bluntly telling voters to expect a tax increase if he won, died Monday. He was 93. The death of the former senator, ambassador, and Minnesota attorney general was announced in a statement from his family. No cause was cited. Mondale followed the trail blazed by his political mentor, Hubert H. Humphrey, from Minnesota politics to the U.S. Senate and the vice presidency, serving under Jimmy Carter from 1977 to 81. In a statement Monday night, Carter said he considered Mondale, quote, the best vice president in our country's history. He added, Fritz Mondale provided us with all with a model of for public service and private behavior, end quote. President Joe Biden said of Mondale, quote, there have been few senators before or since who commanded such universal respect. It was Walter Mondale who defined the vice presidency as a full partnership and helped provide a model for my service, end quote. Mondale's own try for the White House in 1984 came at the zenith of Ronald Reagan's popularity. His selection of Representative Geraldine Ferraro of New York as his running mate made him the first major party presidential nominee to put a woman on the ticket, but his declaration that he would praise taxes helped define the race. On election day, he carried only his home state and the District of Columbia. The elected vote was 525-13 for Reagan, the biggest landslide in the Electoral College since Franklin Roosevelt defeated Alf Landon in 1936. Senator George McGovern got his 17 electoral votes in his 1972 defeat, winning Massachusetts and Washington, D.C. Quote, I did my best, end quote, Mondale said the day after the election and blamed no one but himself. Quote, I think you know I've never really warmed up to television, he said. In fairness to television, it never really warmed up to me, end quote. Years later, Mondale said his campaign message had proven to be the right one. Quote, history has vindicated me that we would have to raise taxes, he said. It was very unpopular, but it was undeniably correct, end quote. In 2002, state and national Democrats looked to Mondale when Senator Paul Wellstone, Democrat of Minnesota, was killed in a plane crash less than 2 weeks before Election Day. Mondale agreed to stand in for Wellstone, and early polls showed him with a lead over the Republican candidate, Norm Coleman. But the 53-year-old Coleman, emphasizing his youth and vigor, out-hustled the then 74-year-old Mondale in an intense 6-day campaign. Mondale was also hurt by a partisan memorial service for Wellstone, in which thousands of Democrats booed Republican politicians in attendance. One speaker pleaded, quote, "We are begging you to help us win this election for Paul Wellstone," end quote. Poll showed the service put off independents and cost Mondale votes. Coleman won by 3 percentage points. Quote, "The Uelligers were the ones hurt the most," end quote, Mondale said after the election. "It doesn't justify it, but we all make mistakes. Can't we now find it in our hearts to forgive them and go on," end quote. It was a particularly bitter defeat for Mondale, who even after his loss to Reagan had taken solace in his perfect record in Minnesota. Moving to the nation and world section, climate, greenhouse gases, emissions cuts planned, Biden to pledge to trim discharges by at least half, sources say, by Matthew Daly, Associated Press, Washington. President Joe Biden will pledge to cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions at least in half by 2030 as he convenes a virtual climate summit with 40 world leaders, according to three people with knowledge of the White House plans. The 50% target would nearly double the nation's previous commitment and help the Biden administration prod other countries for ambitious emissions cuts as well. The proposal would require dramatic changes in the power and transportation sectors, including significant increases in renewable energy such as wind and solar power, and steep cuts in emissions from fossil fuels such as coal and oil. The non-binding but symbolically important pledge is a key element of the two-day summit, which begins Thursday as world leaders gather online to share strategies to combat climate change. The emissions target has been eagerly awaited by all sides of the climate debate. It will signal how aggressively Biden wants to move on global warming, a divisive and expensive issue that has riled Republicans to complain about job-killing government overreach, even as some on the left worry Biden has not gone far enough to address a profound threat to the planet. The three people who know about the White House plan spoke on condition of anonymity on Tuesday because they were not authorized to discuss the pledge ahead of Biden's announcement. Biden has sought to ensure that the 2030 goal, known as a nationally determined contribution, or NDC, is aggressive enough to have a tangible impact on climate change efforts while also being achievable under a closely divided Congress. The climate target is a key requirement of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, which Biden rejoined on his first day in office. It also an important marker as Biden moves toward his ultimate goal of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Scientists, environmental groups, and even business leaders had called on Biden to set a target that would cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by at least 50% below 2005 levels by 2030. Quote, "Wow, that's ambition with a capital A," end quote, Georgia Tech climate scientist Kim Cobb said. Quote, "That target would put us roughly in line with the most ambitious emissions reductions targets," end quote, projected by scientists and environmentalists. Senator John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming, the top Republican on the Senate Energy Committee, said Biden's pledge would set, quote, "punishing targets," end quote, for the U.S., even as adversaries such as China and Russia, quote, "continue to increase emissions at will," end quote. Our next article, U.S. works to guard electrical system. Innovative encourages plant owners to boost cyber defenses, by Eric Tucker, Associated Press, Washington. The Biden administration is taking steps to protect the country's electricity system from cyber attacks through a new 100-day initiative combining federal government agencies and private industry. The initiative, announced Tuesday by the Energy Department, encourages owners and operators of power plants and electrical utilities to improve their capabilities for identifying cyber threats to their networks. It includes concrete milestones for them to put technologies into use so they can spot and respond to intrusions in real time. The department is also soliciting recommendations from electric utilities, energy companies, government agencies, and others for how to safeguard the energy system and supply chain. Quote, innovative partnerships like these are essential to addressing the urgent cybersecurity challenge because much of our critical infrastructure is owned and operated by the private sector, end quote. Emily Horn, a spokeswoman for the White House National Security Council, said in a statement, the effort underscores the heightened concern about the prospects for cyber attacks that disrupt the power supply. The report recommended that the Energy Department, the primary federal agency for the energy sector, do more to address those risks. And our last article, EU agency advocates use of J&J vaccines. Agency finds possible link to blood clots once label warning. By Maria Cheng, Associated Press, London. The European Union's Drug Regulatory Agency said Tuesday that it found a, quote, possible link, end quote, between Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine and extremely rare blood clots and recommended a warning be added to the label. But experts at the agency reiterated that the vaccine's benefits outweighs the risk. The European Medicines Agency made its determination after examining a small number of clot cases in people vaccinated in the U.S. It said these problems should be considered, quote, very rare side effects of the vaccine, end quote. J&J immediately announced it will revise its label as requested and resume vaccine shipments to the EU, Norway, and Iceland. In a statement, it said, quote, the safety and well-being of the people who use our product is our number one priority, end quote. EU Health and Food Safety Commissioner Stella Kyriakides tweeted that vaccinations save lives and added, quote, I urge member states to follow the opinion of our experts, end quote. Dutch Health Minister Hugo de Jonge said the Netherlands would start immunizing with the J&J vaccine on Wednesday. In March, the EMA, which oversees the use of pharmaceutical products in 27 counties across the continent with a combined population of about 448 million, likewise recommended a label change for AstraZeneca's vaccine after finding a link between it and rare blood clots. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, April 21st on Iris. I'm your reader, Erin. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful day.